Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 9 of Three Men in a Boat.
It is very strange, this domination of our intellect by our digestive organs. We cannot work, we cannot think, unless our stomach wills so. It dictates to us our emotions, our passions. After eggs, it says, work. After a thick slice of meat, it says, sleep. After a cup of tea, 2 spoonfuls for each cup, and don't let it stand more than 3 minutes, it says to the brain, now rise and show your strength. Be eloquent and deep and tender. See with a clear eye into nature and into life. Spread your white wings of quivering thought and soar a godlike spirit over the whirling world beneath you, up through the long lanes of flaming stars to the gates of eternity. After hot muffins, it says, be dull and soulless, like a beast of the field, a brainless animal with listless eye, unlit by any ray of fancy, or of hope, or fear, or love, or life. And after tonic, taken in sufficient quantity, it says, now come, fool, grin and tumble, that your fellow men may laugh drivel in folly, and sputter in senseless sound, and show what a helpless ninny is poor man, whose wit and will are drowned like kittens side by side in a half inch of tonic. We are but the veriest, sorriest slaves of our stomach. Reach not after morality and righteousness, my friends. Watch vigilantly your stomach, and diet it with care and judgment. Then virtue and contentment will come and reign within your heart, unsought by any effort of your own, and you will be a good citizen, a loving husband, and a tender father, a noble, pious man. Before our supper, Harris and George and I were quarrelsome and snappy and ill-tempered. After our supper, we sat and beamed at one another, and we beamed upon the dog, too. We loved each other, we loved everybody. Harris, in moving about, trod on George's corn. Had this happened before supper, George would have expressed wishes and desires concerning Harris's fate in this world and the next that would have made a thoughtful man shudder. As it was, he said, steady on, old man, ware wheat. And Harris, instead of merely observing, in his most unpleasant tones, that a fellow could hardly help treading on some bit of George's foot, if he had to move about at all within 10 yards of where George was sitting, suggested that George never ought to come into an ordinary-sized boat with feet that large, and advising him to hang them over the side, as he would have done before supper, now said, oh, I'm so sorry, old chap. I hope I haven't hurt you. And George said, not at all. It was his fault. And Harris said, no, it was his. it was pretty quiet to hear them. We sat looking out on the quiet night and talked. George said, "Why could we not be always like this away from the world, with its sin and temptation, leading sober and peaceful lives and doing good?" I said it was the sort of thing I had often longed for myself, and we discussed the possibility of our going away, we four, to some handy, well-fitted desert island and living there in the woods. Harris said that the danger about desert islands, as far as he had heard, was that they were so damp. But George said, "No, not if properly drained." And then we got on to drains, and that put George in mind of a very funny thing that happened to his father once. He said his father was traveling with another fellow through Wales, and one night they stopped at a little inn where there were some other fellows, and they joined the other fellows and spent the evening with them. They had a very jolly evening and sat up late, and by the time they came to go to bed, this was when George's father was a very young man, they were slightly jolly, too. They, George's father and George's father's friend, were to sleep in the same room, but in different beds. They took the candle and went up. The candle lurched up against the wall when they got into the room, and it went out, and they had to undress and grope into bed in the dark. This they did, but instead of getting into separate beds, as they thought they were doing, they both climbed into the same one without knowing it. One was getting in with his head at the top, the other crawling in from the opposite side of the compass and lying his feet on the pillow. There was silence for a moment, and then George's father said, "Joe." "What's the matter, Tom?" replied Joe's voice from the other end of the bed. "Why, there's a man in my bed," said George's father. "Here's his feet on my pillow." "Well, it's an extraordinary thing, Tom," answered the other, "but I'm blessed if there isn't a man in my bed, too." "What are you going to do?" asked George's father. "Well, I'm going to chuck him out," replied Joe. "So am I," said George's father valiantly. There was a brief struggle, followed by two heavy bumps on the floor, and then a rather doleful voice said, "I say, Tom."
"Yes."
"How have you got on?"
"Well, to tell you the truth, my man's chucked me out."
"So mine," I say. "I don't think much of this inn, do you?"
"What was the name of that inn?" said Harris.
"The Pig and Whistle," said George. "Why?"
No, then it isn't the same," replied Harris.
"What do you mean?" queried George.
"Why, it's so curious," murmured Harris. "But precisely that very same thing happened to my father once at a country inn. I've often heard him tell the tale. I thought it might have been the same inn." We turned in at 10 that night, and I thought I would sleep well, being tired, but I didn't. As a rule, I undress and put my head on the pillow, and then somebody bangs at the door and says it's 8:30. But tonight, everything seemed against me. The novelty of it all, the hardness of the boat, the cramped position. I was lying with my feet under one seat and my head on another. The sound of the lapping water around the boat and the wind among the branches kept me restless and disturbed. I did get to sleep for a few hours, and then some part of the boat, which seemed to have grown up in the night, for it certainly was not there when we started, and it had disappeared by the time morning, kept digging into my spine. I slept through it for a while, dreaming that I had swallowed a sovereign, and that they were cutting a hole in my back with a gimlet, so as to try and get it out. I thought it very unkind of them, and I told them I would owe them the money, and they would have it at the end of the month. But they would not hear of that, and said it would be much better if they had it then, because otherwise the interest would accumulate so. I got quite cross with them after a bit, and told them what I thought of them, and then they gave the gimlet such an excruciating wrench that I woke up. The boat seemed stuffy and my head ached, so I thought I would step out into the cool night air. I slipped on what clothes I could find, some of my own, and some of George's, and some of Harris's, and crept under the canvas onto the bank. It was a glorious night. The moon had sunk, and I left the quiet earth alone with the stars. It seemed as if, in the silence and hush, while we, her children, slept, they were talking with her, her sister conversing of mighty mysteries in voices too vast and deep for childish human ears to catch the sound. They awe us, these strange stars, so cold, so clear. We are as children whose small feet have strayed into some dim-lit temple of the god. They have been taught to worship, but not know. And, standing where the echoing dome spans the long vista of the shadowy light, glance up, half hoping, half afraid to see some awful vision hovering there. And yet it seems so full of comfort and strength, the night. In its great presence our small sorrows creep away, ashamed. The day has been so full of fret and care, and our hearts have been so full of evil and of bitter thoughts, and the world has seemed so hard and wrong to us. Then night, like some great loving mother, gently lays her hand upon our fevered head and turns our little tear-stained faces up to hers and smiles. And, though she does not speak, we know what she would say, and lay our hot flushed cheeks against her bosom, and the pain is gone. Sometimes our pain is very deep and real, and we stand before her very silent, because there is no language for our pain, only a moan. Night's heart is full of pity for us. She cannot ease our aching. She takes our hand in hers, and the little world grows very small and very far away beneath us. And borne on her dark wings, we pass for a moment into a mightier presence than our own. And in the wondrous light of that great presence, all human life lies like a book before us, and we know that pain and sorrow are but the angels of God. Only those who have worn the crown of suffering can look upon that wondrous light, and they, when they return, may not speak of it or tell the mystery they know. Once upon a time in a strange country, there rode some goodly knights, and their path lay by a deep wood, where tangled briars grew very thick and strong, and tore the flesh of them that lost their way therein. And the leaves of the trees that grew in the wood were very dark and thick, so that no ray of light came through the branches to lighten the gloom and sadness. And, as they passed by that dark wood, one knight of those that rode, missing his comrades, wandered far away and returned to them no more. And they, sorely grieving, rode on without him, mourning him as one dead. Now, when they reached the fair castle towards which they had been journeying, they stayed there many days and made merry. And one night, as they sat in cheerful ease around the logs that burned in the great hall, and drank a loving measure, there came the comrade they had lost, and greeted them. His clothes were ragged like a beggar's, and many sad wounds were on his sweet flesh. But upon his face there shone a great radiance of deep joy. And they questioned him, asking him what had befallen him. And he told them how in the dark wood he had lost his way, and had wandered many days and nights, till, torn and bleeding, he had lain him down to die. Then, when he was nigh unto death, lo, through the savage gloom there came to him a stately maiden, and took him by the hand and led him on through devious paths unknown to any man, until upon the darkness of the wood there dawned a light such as the light of day, but as a little lamp unto the sun. And in that wondrous light our wayworn knight saw, as in a dream, a vision, and so glorious, so fair the vision seemed, that of his bleeding wounds he thought no more, but stood as one entranced, whose joy is deep as is the sea, whereof no man can tell the depth. And the vision faded, and the knight, kneeling upon the ground, thanked the good saint who into that sad wood had strayed his step. So he now had seen the vision there hid. And in the name of the dark forest was sorrow, but of the vision that the good knight saw, we may not speak nor tell. Chapter 11. I awoke at 6 the next morning and found George awake too. We both turned round and tried to go to sleep again, but we could not. Had there been any particular reason why we should not have gone to sleep again, but have got up and dressed then and there, we should have dropped off while we were looking at our watches and slept until 10. As there was no earthly necessity for our getting up under another 2 hours at the very least, and our getting up at that time was an utter absurdity, it was only in keeping with the natural cussedness of things in general that we should both feel that lying down for 5 minutes more would be the death of us. George said that the same kind of thing, only worse, had happened to him some 18 months ago when he was lodging by himself in a house of a certain Mrs. Gippings. He said his watch went wrong one evening and stopped at 8:15. He did not know this at the time because, for some reason or other, he forgot to wind it up when he went to bed, an unusual occurrence with him, and he hung it up over his pillow without ever looking at the thing. It was in the winter when this happened, very near the shortest day, and a week of fog into the bargain, so that the fact it was still very dark when George woke up in the morning was no guide to him as to the time. He reached up and hauled down his watch. It was 8:15. "Angels and ministers of grace defend us," exclaimed George, "and here have I got to be in the city by 9. Why didn't someone call me? Oh, this is a shame," and he flung the watch down and sprang out of bed and had a cold bath and washed himself and dressed himself and shaved himself in cold water because there was no time to wait for the hot, and then rushed and had another look at his watch. Whether the shaking it had received in being thrown down on the bed had started it, or how it was, George could not say. But certain it was that from 8:15 it had begun to go and now pointed to 9:20. George snatched it up and rushed downstairs. In the sitting room, all was dark and silent. There was no fire, no breakfast. George said it was a wicked shame of Mrs. G., and he made up his mind to tell her what he thought of her when he came home in the evening. Then he dashed on his greatcoat and hat and seized his umbrella and made for the front door. The door was not even unbolted. George thought it was very, very strange that people could not get up at a decent, respectable time, unlock and unbolt the door, and ran out. He ran hard for 1/4 mile, and at the end of that distance, it began to be borne in upon him as strange and curious thing that there were so few people about, and there were no shops open. It was certainly a very dark and foggy morning, but it still seemed an unusual course to stop all business on that account. He had got to go to business. Why should other people stop in bed merely because it was dark and foggy? At length he reached Holborn. Not a shutter was down. Not a bus was about. There were 3 men in sight, one of whom was a policeman. A market cart full of cabbages, and a dilapidating-looking cab. George pulled out his watch and looked at it. It was 9:05. He stood still and counted his pulse. He stooped down and felt his legs. Then, with his watch still in his hand, he went up to the policeman and asked him if he knew what time it was. "What's the time?" replied the man, eyeing George up and down with evident suspicion. "Why, if you listen, you will hear it strike." George listened, and a neighboring clock immediately obliged. "But it's only gone 3, said George in an injured tone when it had finished.
"Well, and how many did you want it to go?" replied the constable.
"Why, 9, said George, showing his watch.
"Do you know where you live?" said the guardian of public order severely.
George thought and gave the address.
"Oh, that's where it is it?" replied the man. "Well, you take my advice and go there quietly, and take that watch of yours with you, and don't let's have any more of it." And George went home, musing as he walked along, and let himself in. At first, when he got in, he determined to undress and go to bed again. But when he thought of the redressing and rewashing and having another bath, he determined he would not, but would sit up and go to sleep in an easy chair. But he could not get to sleep. He never felt more wakeful in his life, so he lit the lamp and got out the chessboard and played himself a game of chess. But even that did not enliven him. It seemed slow somehow. So he gave the chess up and tried to read. He did not seem to be able to take any sort of interest in reading either, so he put on his coat again and went out for a walk. It was horribly lonesome and dismal, and all the policemen he met regarded him with undisguised suspicion, and turning their lanterns on him and followed him about, and this had such an effect upon him at last that he began to feel as if he really had done something, and he got to slinking down the by-streets and hiding in dark doorways when he heard the regulation flip-flop approaching. Of course, this conduct made the force only more distrustful of him than ever, and they would come out and rout him out and ask him what he was doing there, and when he answered, nothing, he had merely come out for a stroll. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. They looked as though they did not believe him, and 2 plainclothes constables came home with him to see if he really did live where he said he did. They saw him go in with his key, and then they took up a position opposite and watched the house. He thought he would light the fire when he got inside and make himself some breakfast, just to pass away the time. But he did not seem able to handle anything from a scuttle full of coals to a teaspoon without dropping it or falling over it, and making such a noise that he was in mortal fear that it would wake Mrs. G. up, and that she would think it was burglars, and open the window and call, "Police!" And then these 2 detectives would rush in and handcuff him and march him off to the police court. He was in a morbidly nervous state by this time, and he pictured the trial, and his trying to explain the circumstances to the jury, and nobody believing him, and his being sentenced to 20 years penal servitude, and his mother dying of a broken heart. So he gave up trying to get breakfast and wrapped himself up in his overcoat and sat in the easy chair until Mrs. G. came down at 7:30. He said he had never got up too early since that morning. It had been such a warning to him. We had been sitting huddled up in our rugs while George had been telling me this true story, and on his finishing it, I set to work to wake up Harris with the skull. The 3rd prod did it, and he turned over on the other side, and said he would be down in a minute, and that he would have his lace-up boots. We soon let him know where he was, however, by the aid of a hitcher, and he sat up suddenly, sending Montmorency, who had been sleeping the sleep of the just right in the middle of his chest, sprawling across the boat. Then we pulled up the canvas, and all 4 of us poked our heads out over the offside and looked down at the water and shivered. The idea, overnight, had been that we would get up early in the morning, fling off our rugs and shawls, and throwing back the canvas, spring into the river with a joyous shout and revel in a long, delicious swim. Somehow, now the morning had come, the notion seemed less tempting. The water looked damp and chilly. The wind felt cold. "Well, who's going to be first in?" said Harris at last.
There was no rush for precedence. George settled the matter so far as he was concerned by retiring into the boat and pulling on his socks. Montmorency gave vent to an involuntary howl, as if merely thinking of the thing had given him the horrors. And Harris said it would be so difficult to get into the boat again, and went back and sorted out his trousers. I did not altogether like to give in, though I did not relish the plunge. There might be snags about, or weeds, I thought. I meant to compromise matters by going down to the edge and just throwing the water over myself. So I took a towel and crept out on the bank and wormed my way along on the branch of a tree that dipped down into the water. It was bitterly cold. The wind cut like a knife. I thought I would not throw the water over myself after all. I would go back into the boat and dress, and I turned to do so, and as I turned, the silly branch gave way, and I and the towel went in together with a tremendous splash, and I was out midstream with a gallon of Thames water inside me before I knew what happened. "By Jove, old Jay's gone in," I heard Harris say as I came blowing to the surface. "I didn't think he'd have the pluck to do it, did you?" "Is it all right?" sang out George. "Lovely," I sputtered back. "You are duffers not to come in. I wouldn't have missed this for the worlds. Why won't you try it? It only wants a little determination." But I could not persuade them. Rather an amusing thing happened while dressing that morning. I was very cold when I got back into the boat, and in my hurry to get my shirt on, I accidentally jerked it into the water. It made me awfully wild, especially as George burst out laughing. I could not see anything to laugh at, and I told George so, and he only laughed the more. I never saw a man laugh so much. I quite lost my temper with him at last, and I pointed out to him what a driveling maniac of an imbecile idiot he was, but he only roared the louder. And then, just as I was landing the shirt, I noticed that it was not my shirt at all, but George's, which I had mistaken for mine. Whereupon the humor of the thing struck me for the first time, and I began to laugh.
You have been listening to episode 9 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 10 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.
Down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. All Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortunes of fame. He never seems to hurry, but he gets there just the same. Kingdoms may come, kingdoms may go, whatever the end may be. All Father Thames.